to talk to you about characterizing useful quantum computers, and this is joint work with quite a lot of people, some of whom I think I've mentioned everyone here at the moment, particularly the experimental team at the University of Innsbruck, especially Alex Erhardt and Philip Schindler, and Joe Emerson at the University of Waterloo, and Steve Flamir and Robin Harper at the University of Sydney. So,
why in your title you put useful quantum computers?
Yeah, I will get to that. So I'm just going to start by saying, what does a useful quantum computer need to be useful? There are actually some specific challenges related to characterizing something that is useful that I don't think people have had to think about, because we don't have a useful quantum computer yet. And then I'm going to talk about some of the ways we estimate trying to characterize how useful a quantum computer is. In particular, the standard at the moment is randomized benchmarking, and how we can get more efficient estimators out of that and actually choose how to design experiments, because it's one of the most common complaints from experimentalists is that a theory paper says choose some sequence length and some number of repetitions and leaves it at that. And then briefly mention the limitations of randomized benchmarking and a new protocol that I've developed called cycle benchmarking, which overcomes those limitations. And then I'll look at an experimental implementation of cycle benchmarking in ion traps, which gives fidelities for up to 10 qubit gates in about 2 hours. So that's not too bad in terms of experimental time so far. So at the moment, what makes a quantum computer useful? I'm not actually going to talk from the kind of DiVincenzo criteria of how do you build a scalable one. I'm more just thinking from the purpose of someone hands you a box, it's got some qubits in it, and how do you know when that is actually useful? How is that useful compared to a digital computer? Well, in order to be useful, it needs three things. It needs a reasonable number of qubits, universal operations, or at least reasonably universal, and it needs low error rates. And you need the first two things because if you have too few qubits, or if you have too restricted a set of operations, then you can efficiently simulate it, and so there is nothing that can be achieved with that box that you couldn't achieve with a laptop, or at worst, a supercomputer. And then if the quantum computer has too much noise, the output is unreliable. And one of the things that's become clear is when people are talking about quantum chemistry algorithms, for instance, that have 10 to the 10 gates, that means you really need error rates on the order of 10 to the minus 11 in the most benign models possible before you've got any hope of getting anything useful out of it. So, you know, part of the challenge you have is characterizing very large devices that operate at very small error rates. And how do we characterize these three features? Well, many qubits, that's easy, you count them. But for the universal-ish operations and low error rates, particularly for the low error rates in a scalable way, the main thing that's done at the moment, the only really practical option is randomized benchmarking, or things that are based on it. So what is randomized benchmarking? And the basic idea, randomized benchmarking is in technical terms, it's a complicated way of doing nothing, but taking a long time to do it. And then based on how well you've done nothing as a function of how long you've been doing it, you get an idea of your error rate. Strictly speaking, there are some debates about what that error rate means, but in the loosest possible sense, it's the error rate when you don't try and do anything interesting with your quantum computer. And so the basic, in more technical terms, you apply a random sequence of gates from a group that multiplies to the identity, and you look at the average probability of an outcome, or a set of outcomes, it doesn't actually matter, overall sequences, and it has this nice characteristic decay, a p to the m plus b. And the decay parameter is linearly related to the fidelity, which is a standard figure of merit. And there are other figures of merit, I'm not actually going to discuss that at the moment. But there are two key issues. The first one is, how does the error in the estimate of the error rate scale with the error rate? And yeah, making sure I didn't mispronounce that, there's three different errors in there. So, but it is actually a tricky and a key question. And then the other one is, how do we efficiently characterize a universal gate set? Because if you want to make sure that the group multiplies to the identity, that requires an inverse, and that can't be done efficiently in general. Now, the span parameters, A and B in this term, they depend on the state preparation and measurement, so they're called spam. Everyone knows spam is awful. Both the food and the parameters. So these are nuisances. I mean that actually in two senses. These are technically nuisance parameters of the model in that no one cares about them. They maybe should, but at the moment no one does. They only care about P, and so they just complicate your fitting process. In a casual sense, they're also nuisances because having three parameters actually means you need a lot more resources in order to get this, to get a specific precision in your estimate of your decay rate. So you need to, you know, one of the standard ways would be to go out to a very long length and to try and get the asymptotic decay, the asymptotic value. Other ways that there are a variety of different ways to deal with this span parameter. The most rigorous one, so people have alternated between just setting it to have some value, trying to measure it, and or another idea, which is generalizing an idea by Nil in 2008, is to randomly choose to compile to any gate that flips the final outcome, and then just relabeling your probabilities. And when you do that, you can actually prove this is robust to gate-dependent noise. Essentially, the B parameter goes to 1 minus B, and the average of B and 1 minus B is a half. So you've managed to get rid of it. Now, that's a very simple observation, but it actually allows something fairly powerful. So the first thing is it actually allows us to do a kind of closed-form analytic and heuristic arguments as to how do you estimate the decay rate, which was just a little more complicated with three parameters, and everything's much simpler with two. In particular, you can solve, if you just use two different values for m, and you get this, the p to the power of delta m is just given by essentially a ratio of probabilities. Now, I would comment that if any of the terms in that fraction at the top, I'm going to see, yeah, this doesn't look funny. If any of these terms are negative, or in particular, if the ratio is negative, then you've got a p-value less than zero, that doesn't, or complex, that doesn't make sense. So what you can do is just do a truncation. And as long as you've chosen your sequence lengths appropriately, that should have a very low probability of occurring. Now we can choose the shortest sequence length. We have to choose at this magic number 4, just to avoid gate-dependent perturbations. But then experimentally, so you know, in theorist land, we then have two exact values obtained by averaging over all sequences, and we can just plug them in and get the exact average gate fidelity. Experimentally, you tend to have additive uncertainties, so you have estimates of the average over different sequences and additive uncertainties. And you can essentially, because this is such a simple formula, you can propagate these epsilon i's through. And then provided you're in this regime where you are essentially set chalk. Here we go. So if you're going back to undergraduate physics, you're estimating a straight line, what do? You take one thing here, and then you go out as far as possible over here, and then essentially the difference there, essentially providing, by taking a greater separation, you get a lever that enhances the resolution. Now, for an exponential, it's almost the same, except if you go too far, If you go to here, you've lost all your signal completely, and so you've basically gained no information, and any uncertainty here really propagates to a fairly large uncertainty in your actual decay rate. So the answer is you want to be essentially here and here to get as much information out as you possibly can. And so this condition that you don't want to be too far out is reflected by this requirement. The uncertainty at your longer sequence is not too big compared to your decay value. And then provided you satisfy that condition, and I don't know why it's flickering in and out, then the uncertainty on your true decay rate is equal to your estimated decay rate plus essentially your additive uncertainties over the difference in sequence lengths. And what's quite nice here is that as long as you choose the gap between them to be big enough, in particular, you can choose it to be about 1 on R, where R is the average gate infidelity, or 1 minus F, then you actually get a multiplicative precision on your estimate on your error rate. Now, so even a factor of 2 times the sum of the individual uncertainties. So that means that provided you can do long enough sequences, by being able to get rid of this nuisance parameter, you've managed to solve it so you can get a multiplicative precision estimate so you don't have to add extra resources in terms of individual numbers of experiments as your error rates go down. Now, of course, your individual experiments get longer, but at the same time, that's somehow fundamental. If you are trying to characterize a really, really short, a really tiny error rate, and you want to do it very precisely, you need to do a really long experiment, or else you can't really. You know, if you're saying you have an error rate of 10 to the minus 12, but you can only do 100 gates, then that's probably not accurate. You really should say it's more like 10 to the minus 2, because that's as many as you can do. So fitting with 2 points is actually something that's statisticians that you should perhaps be a little uneasy about. So I'm going to briefly discuss the pros and cons. And the main advantage is that under the decay model, if you want to know how to get the minimal uncertainty for fixed resources, you should dump all your resources into 2 points. That is provably the thing that will give you the fastest answer. Now, that has the flip side to that is if you don't trust your model, then what you should be trying to do is trying to get the most precise prediction under the assumption that your model is true and then falsify it, which essentially you still want to get the most precise estimate possible. Now, one of the other advantages is that the estimator suddenly becomes straightforward. This fraction, this guy here, moving the power over to the other side. That thing is the least squares estimator. It's the weighted least squares estimator. As far as I understand, it's the maximum likelihood estimator. It's basically going to be any kind of estimator you care about, which means that there's now no possibility of gaming the system by trying to choose an estimator that gives you something nice. The next thing is that you don't need to weigh your data points. One of the things that's actually quite nasty is you can see that in order to get a good estimate on a decay, you want a big vertical separation. And you want to assign high weight to both short data points and long data points in order to get this separation. But data points here are very close to 1. Data points here are very close to 1/2. And so you get much greater variance at this length than you do at this length. And so unless you put essentially the bulk of your time and the bulk of, if you, for instance, do the one of the standard things that people think to do, which is you linearly space your sequence lengths, you're going to be putting in a lot of time and most of the weight will get put on the points back here, which don't actually provide a lot of information. The other thing you get is you get a clearly motivated choice of sequence lengths and a simple error analysis, and everything's relatively insensitive to the distribution to the fact that different sequences actually have different probabilities. Now, the primary disadvantage is that if you just use two points, you have no model validation whatsoever, and we all know that models are wrong. All models are wrong. That's kind of a standard practical applied statistics aphorism. However, as soon as you have, you can use the same analysis for the other spam, for the spam coefficient A, then you can start doing hypothesis testing on independent sequence lengths. And if you're doing that, you may as well, if they don't flag as that the model is invalid, then you may as well use Bayesian methods to update to get a more concise posterior. So this, at the very least, is, I think, a reasonable way to approach the problem. It's probably the most principled one at the moment. At the moment, everyone's kind of doing ad hoc ones that either take a lot of computational resources or appeal to certain assumptions about distributions of individual sequences. Now, what's wrong with standard randomized benchmarking? So we now know that actually randomized benchmarking solves one of the problems. Multiplicative precision error rates mean that you can practically estimate very small error rates. But, and it is scalable, but it has two key limitations. The first, and I don't know why I put this at the bottom of the slide, but anyway, first is that it doesn't apply to a universal gate set. That's a big problem. The second is that while it's efficient, polynomial factors matter. And in particular, so a lot of you, randomized benchmarking has been heavily done at IBM. They've pushed this forward quite a long way. And they've only just done, they have had a 16-qubit chip for a while now. They've only done 3-qubit randomized benchmarking. Anyone want to know why? It's because the estimate you would get if you tried to do 16-qubit randomized benchmarking would be atrocious, even under the most benign assumptions about noise, which we know are not true. And so if you assume no crosstalk and everything couples nicely, then if you have a typical n-qubit Clifford gate, it needs n squared on log n or n log n times various log factors that I never remember. Which each have some infidelity R. And that means that the fidelity of a typical Clifford is roughly 1 minus some constant times the infidelity of a generator times n squared, or n squared on log n. But it could actually be anywhere in a very large interval. And even in the most, so this value here is essentially assuming purely stochastic noise. And even for 10 qubits, that's 100. So, you know, an error rate of 10 to the minus 3 on a single generating gate gives you an error per 10-qubit Clifford of 10%. And you just cannot do much of a decay if your decay rate is 0.9. It's just going to be, you can't fit that. And no one would want to publish it either, just because it doesn't sound so great. So how can we solve this? Well, randomized benchmarking requires those that many gates because it's twirling noise to, I forgot a key word there, global depolarizing noise. As soon as you're twirling to global depolarizing noise, you have the nice property that it's completely characterized by, it's a one parameter family of noise and the parameter is related to the average gate fidelity. But in order to get a global depolarizing channel, you need entangling gates. There's just no way you can do it without them. And that means that you're going to essentially need entangling gates between every pair of qubits, and that's essentially where the n squared comes from. So the solution is to perform a weaker twirl. And the advantage here is that you can actually characterize universal gate sets because you can correct a twirl through a, you can correct a weaker twirl, you can propagate a weaker twirl through a larger set of gates. But the trade-off is, you know, there's no such thing as a free lunch. Here, this is more like a lunch that costs 5 cents. So the resulting noise is more complicated. And this, at first, scared me quite a bit. It's described by 4 to the n Pauli fidelities. So we've gone from a one parameter thing to 4 to the n parameters. That sounds bad, especially if you're going to have to estimate all of them. It sounds really, you know, that's just completely impossible. But what's nice is that the fidelity is essentially the average Pauli fidelity. So the Pauli fidelity is basically the average gate fidelity is what's the overlap of an input state under your map with what it should be. And the Pauli fidelity is the same thing, but for a Pauli matrix. So the Pauli fidelity is basically the average, the fidelity is essentially the average Pauli fidelity because Paulis are a one design. There's a D here and there's a D here, so it's there's no bad constants. It's just needed to write it that way. So what that means then is that you can, as soon as you see that it's an average, you go, well, okay, I just randomly sample and estimate based on the average. So the heuristic idea is you can sample a bunch of Pauli fidelities and average to get an estimate of the fidelity. Now, I've been talking a fair bit up until now about the importance of multiplicative precision or procedures that scale well for very small errors. And you might think, well, hang on, how many of these guys do I need to average over to in order to get a multiplicative precision estimate? And it turns out very few. In fact, you can prove that the Pauli fidelities are within a factor, incredibly tightly concentrated around their mean. They're within plus or minus R of the average gate fidelity, which means that in order to get the right estimate, you can plug it into something like Hoeffding's inequality, you need on the order of something like 20 to 50 Paulis is sufficient for any error rate. So how do we estimate Pauli fidelities? Well, it's actually fairly straightforward. Pretend for a moment that you can actually prepare the state in the first line, which is I plus or minus a Pauli. I'll get to that in a minute. Then you're essentially applying the same thing as a randomized benchmarking technique. You're applying a twirl, then a generic gate, and then you're propagating the twirl through the gate to correct it so that you don't go to some random place in Hilbert space. And you're doing this m times with independent twirling gates. And then you want to measure this the expectation value of where your Pauli should have gone to. And you do that from a computational basis measurement just by coarse graining. Everything that has a plus one is in the plus one eigenspace. And then averaging over twirls and sines fits to this decay curve, A, F to the m plus a half, where F is a Pauli fidelity. And in order to make the above robust to state preparation and measurement errors, in particular the fact that you don't prepare this guy, you prepare n copies of some ground state, for instance, what you do is you add a random Pauli that commutes with P into your first twirl. And what that does is you have prepared some product state here, and then it has a bunch of other Pauli terms in it, but on average those are now going to cancel to zero. And then also you need to choose values of M that give the same power of H, where H is the gate you really want to characterize, so that this measurement procedure is effectively the same. Then you have essentially measurement errors creeping in, and they could do something strange. They probably don't, but I'm a little paranoid. And I forgot to close a bracket. Weird. That just bugged me. So then the advantage of this, just as a few kind of minor points, H can be pretty much any gate that we care about. So anything from, say, the third level of the Clifford hierarchy can usually be done. The main criteria is that you need some unitary one design such that when you propagate elements of the unitary one design through the gate, they remain tensor products of single qubit gates. To make it as useful as possible. Otherwise, you have to correct using entangling gates, and then the analysis becomes more complicated. And so this is actually very similar to, I might just skip that actually. So I've presented this protocol. Is it actually practical? Well, to answer that, we're looking at an implementation in trapped ions. We're using, so here's a schematic of a trapped ion quantum computation. We have our qubits are encoded in the S1/2 and D5. I'm going to pretend I actually understand these details. I'm a theorist. I understand parts of these details. So the essentially these qubits are encoded into two levels of a calcium ion, the S1/2 D5 on 2, and you have essentially this transition here is about 1 second in terms of coherence times. And they use the other nearby levels to do things like cooling and also for stroboscopic decoupling when they want to hide one qubit from the rest. And the particular interactions they're going to do, which I'm mentioning particularly because we had to think about the best way to do this protocol for their operations. So they have a couple of different couplings. So the first and easiest is the, and also somehow the worst, is AC Stark shifts on individual ions, where in order to do Z rotations. So when I say worst, it's more that they have to do this the most often. And so it contributes the largest total error. Then you have everything else is done collectively. So you do global rotations simultaneously around any, they can do any, around any axis in the XY plane, all qubits simultaneously, and they can also do simultaneously all pairwise XX interactions with phases as well. And so the actual gates are just the exponentials of these couplings for arbitrary times. And here's where I am more kind of understanding things. So primarily, they're interested in the n-qubit Molnar-Sorensen gate, which does the has this essentially does a simultaneous two, so SX squared, this is the sum of all single qubit X operators. When you square it, you get all two body ones. And for this particular value of pulse duration, you get a Clifford gate. And so they're looking to see if they can characterize that. And it turns out that the Molnar-Sorensen actually has this magic simple formula for even numbers of qubits, where instead of being all two-body terms, it's actually just a global X interaction, global X Hamiltonian, which makes life much easier because as soon as you have something this simple, you know how to propagate corrections through in a closed form. In particular, if a Pauli doesn't commute with the MS gate, or if it commutes, then the correction's easy. If it doesn't commute, then it just goes to itself multiplied by X tensor N. So that means that the twirling set can be independent Paulis plus independent rotations about the x-axis about any angle, and that's isomorphic to the n copies of the dihedral group. And abstractly, we would have preferred doing pi on 4 x rotations because there's something I didn't show about the protocol is that when you have because you have a non-Pauli gate, it's shuffling Pauli errors between each other. So, you know, if you have an X, if you have a Z error, and then you apply the MS gate, it turns into a Z times the X tensor N error. And so you're getting averages, the Pauli fidelities of these guys get averaged together in a strange way. But it turns out that that's not particularly difficult. If you could twirl over the X, then you would get rid of this effect completely because everything suddenly commutes. But this Pauli scrambling is actually an order R squared effect. So it's good enough to ignore, basically because the Pauli fidelities are all the same. A much bigger constraint is that primitive gates contain only collective rotations and single qubit Z rotations. Now, this is not a fundamental constraint. You can generate arbitrary single qubit gates with this. Essentially, you can just do two fixed global pion 2 pulses and riffle Z pulses in between it. And that's sufficient to generate everything independently. But that needs 3N Z pulses, and that's going to dominate their error. So we wanted to minimize how many are used. So it's much fewer gate. We need much fewer gates to get independent Pauli gates. And how much fewer? Well, in order to find the smallest number possible, which is kind of essentially the algorithm, if you want to do a set, if you want to implement a tensor product of Paulis, you look for the most common Pauli, you choose your global pulses to compile to that Pauli, and then riffle Zs through on the other qubits, and in fact just a Z pi pulse, one Z pi pulse on each of the other qubits that doesn't have that Pauli, and it gets everything. Now the Molmer-Sorensen gate is of order 4. I mentioned we wanted to restrict to choosing H to the M to be constant. We could actually do, with some relabeling, we could use order 2 without too much problems, but it's easy enough to just choose 4. So we chose the sequence length to be 4 and the largest multiple of 4 that gave a decent signal, which for 10 qubits was about 12.
Remind me, what is the order of a gate?
Oh, sorry. The order of a gate is the power that you have to raise it to get the identity. And then we sampled Pauli fidelities exhaustively for 2 and 4 qubits. For 2 qubits, excluding the identity. So for 2 qubits, that's 15. For 4 qubits, it exhausts them. There's 255. But the main point of doing that was actually they wanted to verify that, they and I wanted to verify that sampling around 50 gives you an accurate estimate so that we only ever did 50 for any larger number of qubits. And here are some results. Basically, so here we have a number of qubits along this axis and a fidelity. And there's actually some kind of nice things going on in here. So the red data points, which are usually the lower ones, are the fidelity of a Molmer-Sorensen gate composed with a round of single qubit Paulis. And the blue circles are the fidelities of just a round of independent single qubit Paulis. And the uncertainties are all obtained from bootstrap percentiles. And they're relatively small, actually, so much so that you can't see them for 2 and 4 qubits. Now, the first thing to note is that there's approximately 1.75 pulses per qubit, and the single qubit decay fidelity is consistent with a fidelity of about 0.995, including any crosstalk. So normally when people talk about doing single qubit benchmarking on 1 out of 16 or 1 out of 8 qubits, it's a marginal error of 99.5, but it could be doing who knows what to the other qubits, and that actually means it's a lot. It's really a can only be taken as an estimate of the error if you never do anything else, which is not that interesting. Whereas here, it's actually each Z pulse is about 0.995 fidelity on the global system. So that's quite nice, and it's rather consistent. Now, what about the fidelity of the Molmer-Sorensen gate? As I mentioned, the fidelity we have here is of a Molmer-Sorensen composed with a round of single qubit Paulis. Now, this is actually the quantity that you want if you're implementing things with something like randomized compiling, which is a technique I developed with Joe. The number you get here is actually what you plug in to work out how well your quantum computer will perform. But you would also like to know what the actual fidelity of the Molmer-Sorensen gate is, or the multi-qubit gate in question. And a standard method of estimating the fidelity of an interleaved gate is to take basically the difference between the reference decay and the interleaved decay. And around here, that would give you, you know, a fidelity of essentially 90% for the Malmer-Sorensen gate. Yeah, about 88%, sorry. And then the difference here would be 92 to 84. So I guess about, what's that? About 92 to 93% fidelity. Much better fidelity up here. And a really impressive fidelity up here and up here, in fact, fidelity greater than one. And this really illustrates three things. First, the way of estimating fidelity by taking a difference is really, really bad. It's just known, even in the earliest, it's actually such a bad way that in standard randomized benchmarking, you're better off just guessing that the interleaved error rate is like 12 times, you know, the number of gates times your average error rate is actually a better estimate when you include systematic uncertainties. The other two things that are illustrated is that essentially one of two things is going on in order to get these decay curves. Assuming that the system is relatively stable, which is, you know, a little questionable. But the two explanations are that you have coherent errors cancelling between Malmer-Sorensen gates and Twirling gates, and or you have context-dependent noise on the Twirling gates. Now, we actually think both of these are true. So the Twirling gates include these collective X rotations and a Malmer-Sorensen gate, which use the same laser. It's not, so it actually makes a certain amount of sense that the doing a Malmer-Sorensen will affect the performance of the next collective rotation. It's a little surprising that it might make it better, but that's just life sometimes. We don't understand everything that's going on.
That number one is refocusing in an hour.
Yeah, basically. Yeah, except it's refocusing somehow between two things you wouldn't normally have thought would refocus.
Yeah, usually it's not random focusing. You have to be careful.
Yeah.
And here you say in some weird way, it's not really careful because you don't know which
it's definitely not random. Well, it's definitely random. Yeah. And yet somehow that still seems to work. Now...
simulations of these things, can you understand it?
Yes, there's only a certain amount I can say just because the talk's being recorded, and I can say that we do actually know that, and I'll go to the next slide and then I'll say what I can say based on that. So we want to determine, the first thing we want to determine to try and decide between these two is to determine if the noise is coherent. And the main way we're going to do that is to iterate, instead of applying the Malmer-Sorensen once, we just apply it a variable number of times and look how the fidelity decays as a function of M. And a quadratic, loosely, quadratic decay means coherent errors, linear decay means stochastic errors. There are things with stability, you know, you get fluctuations of different lengths, so it's not exactly quadratic. But speaking of stability and intensity fluctuations, a new laser arrived that should make everything better, so naturally everything got worse. And in particular, instead of being at the 99 for the one Malmer-Sorensen gate, just because they're spending all their time tuning up, playing with the new laser, the fidelity is now 97.4. And then it's going down in this fairly systematic way, which if you squint might be linear, might be coherent. Now, at this point, I was doing some more fine-grained analysis, and you can actually, if you make an ansatz that the... this is not what I did, but what you can reconstruct it. If you make an ansatz that the noise is dominated by a few Pauli error terms, in the Hamiltonian, in particular the XX, which makes sense because that's an over-rotation for the Molman-Sorensen gate, and an XI and ZI error, then you actually find that the XX error is actually coherent. So for the data they used to generate these guys, they hadn't calibrated quite well enough, and there was a big coherent error left over. The other error was actually stochastic, and it turns out, so it's always nice when I tell them, hey, I'm noticing this weird thing about the data, and they're like, yeah, that's because we do this weird thing in the experiment. And it turns out I was noticing a systematically worse error on one qubit, and it's because they don't have to do something. For some reason, they don't actually address both qubits in the same way. And so the one that they have worst trouble addressing is the one that was worse. And that was roughly stochastic.
And that was for four qubits?
That was for two. The four-qubit data, I basically, because they're doing 255 decays, and because the new laser arrived, it's going to take a week to get the new data, assuming they start now, which they won't. That's just the way of experiments, right? So in conclusion, I've presented a relatively complete analysis of the estimates and errors from randomized benchmarking. What I didn't talk about very much is it actually applies to every variant of randomized benchmarking except for one, which is one of the ones I developed. Basically, everything in which you're only concerned with linear quantities, this analysis holds. And standard randomized benchmarking, while efficient in principle, is impractical for large numbers of qubits. But we've developed cycle benchmarking, which is in principle practical. And one of the things I didn't mention too much is that it directly outputs the performance under randomized compiling without further assumptions besides non-Markovianity, which is the elephant in the room. And cycle benchmarking is actually practical for large numbers of qubits. So, you know, we had this whole thing with randomized benchmarking seemed practical, wasn't when you looked at it more closely. Cycle benchmarking actually is practical. I, just as a comment, some reason, I had a different plot here, which they'd done data, and initially for 8 qubits, they had something down here, which they did not expect at all. And it turns out they had part of their device, their Molman-Sorensen was doing something on part of the Hilbert space that they weren't normally sensitive to in their calibration. So they then went from essentially this level right up to here, just by being able to tune it up. And it takes about, at the moment, using more than we need to is probably 2 hours, but we're looking at cutting that down as much as possible.
Give us only one data point, 2 hours for 10 qubits, without telling us how much would it take for 50 qubits.
So it was about 2 hours for both 6, 8, and 10.
It's a constant.
It's roughly constant. As long as you can parallelize everything, it should be constant. If you can't parallelize everything, you're actually in a lot of trouble. You've got bigger problems than how long 50 qubits will take. But everything is done in parallel. This is unlike something like randomized benchmarking in the standard way, you would really have to work and think of how to do it in a parallel way. This one's actually, all the gates are naturally parallel. It's just the way it's set up. There is some potential improvements, particularly if you're tuning up and you know that you want to tune up relative to a particular noise source, you don't have to do the full 2 hours. But that's a side note at the moment. And extracting an accurate fidelity, this is kind of an important point. The number that you get out is actually the number that I personally care about because it tells me how well you're going to be able to use your quantum computer for randomized compiling. But if you want the exact fidelity, then it's going to take some more work. This is actually a standard problem that people have been shortcutting because it basically, when you put it in a random Clifford, everything's sort of going badly anyway. But it becomes because you have much fewer twirling gates, this problem is a lot more pronounced than it was in older randomized benchmarking experiments. And one of the experiments we're particularly keen to implement, though, is to look at implementing the protocol for different fractions of the Molmer-Sorensen gates, so that aren't Clifford gates, and particularly the square root of the Molmer-Sorensen gate. And this would actually demonstrate the first scalable characterization of a non-Clifford gate. Thank you. And any questions? Now's your chance.
So the Molmer-Sorensen gate is really specific to ion trap.
Yes.
Something.
So superconducting qubits actually are looking at different implementations of it. I mean, for me, the only part the specific multi-qubit gate actually played was just the fact that it was a gate that you needed to characterize all n qubits at once. You can't stitch together two qubit characterizations. But if you're parallelizing, let's say you're parallelizing 10 CZs, you probably should not stitch together the estimates from independently characterizing them if you can just characterize them all at once. And the gate there, it can just be a tensor product of CZs. So it works the same there without any particular problems. And it catches crosstalk, which is otherwise neglected.